You may have seen this acronym on office signs, DWYSYWD. Besides running the same backwards and forwards, it stands for Do What You Say You Will Do. Well, that might be the watchword for federal contractors when it comes to even small contract terms. A case now under deliberation by the Supreme Court could open contractors to all sorts of fraud and false claims and lawsuits. Joining me with more, Miles and Stockbridge attorney Eric Crucius. Eric, great to have you on.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
Talk about this case. This is called Universal versus Escobar. It has been argued. What did they argue about?
So just a very quick factual background to give everyone a little bit of context. Escobar essentially represents a plaintiff. The daughter went in for medical services to a clinic, psychological services, and was treated by folks who were not certified to provide the treatments they were supposed to provide. And Universal submitted bills, essentially, that made it seem like the services were performed by folks who were supposed to be properly certified. And long story short, the young woman who was receiving treatment passed away, they say, because of the treatment she received. That's a separate issue, of course. But the issue is whether there's a false claim because Universal submitted those bills to the government like as if the folks who were providing the services were in fact certified to do so. So there wasn't a certification on the bill that they submitted promising that all the services were provided by licensed professionals. But there is this issue of implicit certification, whether that there's implicitly a promise that that happened when they submitted those invoices to the federal government for payment.
Oh, so it was a federal payment case because it was a subcontractor, that is to say it was a recipient of money from CMS?
Yeah, and so it's indirectly, it's through the state program, but inevitably it goes through the federal system, yes.
So what is the implication for contractors? It sounds like it's a form of false claims. Why should all contractors worry about that idea of medical certification?
This has dramatic repercussions for federal contractors because as you've probably seen a lot of contracts, there are a myriad of things that contractors have to comply with when performing on a contract. Any contract would have hundreds of FARs or DFARS provisions in them. You have a lot of different requirements. Even the invoices sometimes have to be submitted a certain way. And under the reasoning that the Supreme Court could come out with, depending on how the decision comes down, any of those things being done wrong can be the basis of an implied certification gone awry, which would open up the contractor to False Claims Act liability, especially with all the new regulations that we're seeing out there. I'll just give you one quick example, if that's okay. We have Fair Pay Safe Workplaces, which is a proposed regulation, which would require contractors to essentially state where they've had certain adverse employment actions against them in the last 3 years when applying for a contract. And in effect, it's checking a box when they're applying for a contract. Perhaps a large contractor doesn't realize that in one of their divisions in a far-off place, there was an adverse employment action against the company, so they don't check the box. Perhaps that would be an implied, and then that contractor gets the award, performs it. Maybe it's a $1 million contract with dozens of invoices submitted over the life of the contract. That contractor could be open to False Claims Act liability because of that unchecked box for three times the amount of the contract plus $11,000 per invoice, or three times the amount of the loss, depending on how the courts look at it.
So False Claims Act and false claims actions are predicated on the assumption that there was deliberate intent to defraud the government, and that's why you go after a contractor. But you're saying in this case, something as inadvertent as a subcontractor or a distant employee doing something technically out of band when there was no intent to defraud the government could be used as defrauding the government.
That's correct. In these instances, there are really two types of false claims. There's a factually false, where a contractor submits an invoice for a service or product that wasn't provided. Then there's this kind of murky, legally false area where this whole case rests, where you have an invoice that was submitted even though a statute, regulation, or term in the contract wasn't complied with. And these legally false things could be something very minor. Like you said, someone far off not doing something correctly. And if you listen to the argument or attended or read the transcript, Justice Breyer really struggled with that. And he's one of the folks who would be on the side of the plaintiff, potentially, theoretically. And he struggled with, well, maybe there should be a materiality aspect to it, where it's not something that is, if it's something minor, such as the wrong color paper that the invoice is submitted on, or maybe not checking that box on the Fair Pay Safe Workplaces regulation, that's not material. Now, he was searching for a bright line rule. I fear, though, that materiality is not really a bright line rule, because what's material and what's not material, that could be litigated in the courts forever. I know as an attorney, I can do pretty well just representing clients on what's material and what's not material. So they're really in search of something that's clear cut, but I think in this instance, they won't find it.
We're speaking with Eric Crucius, an attorney at Miles and Stockbridge. So, for example, one material could be, well, the government got charged $1 million it didn't owe. On the other hand, if the invoice is on the wrong sheet of paper, somebody could claim my assistant fell down in shock because the wrong paper came through, and therefore there was material damage here. That's maybe an exaggeration, but that's what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, you look at all the FARs and DFARs provisions that contractors have to comply with, separate and apart from the contract provisions out, you know, that are in there as well. And I think if you look at any contractor performance, you'll find a contractor falling out of one of those contract provisions or FARs or DFARs provisions on any given contract. It's just there's hundreds and hundreds of requirements, sometimes thousands, depending on the contract. And complying with all of them all the time, 100% of the time, is really difficult. And I always tell folks, in the lifespan of a company's going to make mistakes. It's inevitable. So the key is just trying to minimize those mistakes, addressing them and correcting them, and having good compliance plans that will pick those up. Even the best compliance plans are going to miss some of these things. And if they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, the contractor's in the wrong place at the wrong time, that could be the basis of a False Claims Act, which the damages are substantial when something like that happens.
But getting back to the case here of Universal and Escobar, in fact, they did, it seems, make a false claim by saying medically certified people did this and that, when in fact those people did not do that. So if they argue, that is to say, if Escobar wins and Universal loses, that would be perhaps the right outcome in that case, but the wrong outcome for everybody else.
Perhaps, and I think that's a very astute point. I mean, what you had is the First Circuit, at least in my opinion, taking a more expansive view of it. When courts get an issue, they can narrowly decide the issue, or they can take a more expansive approach. And what the First Circuit did is they went the way of what a lot of courts have gone recently, circuit courts just under the Supreme Court, and making these implied certification cases have value and have merit. This is an area, though, where you have, it's a legally, if true, it's a legally false claim, because the services were actually provided, they just weren't provided by the folks that the government thought would be providing them. So
it's not that cut and dried.
Yeah, it's not so cut and dried. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of sympathy on the plaintiff's side because of what happened to the young lady, but that doesn't make it a false claim necessarily. I mean, you have a lot of circumstances where contractors are subject to a lot of different penalties for not complying with contracts. You know, the contracting officer can take action against the contractor. The contractor could be referred to suspension and debarment, and that may be the more appropriate actions as opposed to False Claims Act cases.
So it sounds like the wrong ruling in this case, or the ruling that would open this possibility up, could really cause arbitrary and capriciousness on the part of contracting officers. If they decided they just don't like the way you part your hair, they could find your company in all sorts of trouble for trivial things.
Right, and contracting officers can potentially use that as a hammer, saying, look, you have a potential False Claims Act here problem, so you should do X, Y, and Z. And I'll just note that there have been a few courts out there who have held that government employees can be relators in False Claims Act cases. There was a Fifth Circuit case about 4 or 5 years ago against an oil company that said that. So there are circumstances where government employees, now they have a tougher time bringing these cases because of a few technical reasons, but under the False Claims Act, the most recent iteration of it in 1986, the way person was defined, it did not include federal government employees. So you can see a scenario where a federal government employee is essentially acting as a relator in circumstances like this as well, although the uphill battle is certainly there.
And when is a decision expected?
Probably by the end of June, we'll see a decision on this case. And there's a lot of potential outcomes here, of course, because we have an eight justice Supreme Court right now. You could very well see a 4-4 decision where it just gets essentially thrown back to the First Circuit and that ruling stands. And you have this split in the circuits where some circuits agree with what the First Circuit did, and others take a much narrower approach like the Second Circuit, which covers New York and Connecticut. But we should see something by June.
Eric Crucius is an attorney with the law firm Miles and Stockbridge. Thanks so much for joining me.
Sure. Wonderful to be here.
Read more and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive and click share with friends.